Behind the Bite podcast is part of a network of podcasts that are good for the world. Check out podcasts like the Full of Shit podcast, After the First Marriage podcast, and Eating Recovery Academy over at practiceofthepractice.com/network. Welcome to Behind the Bite podcast. This podcast is about the real life struggles women face with food, body image, and weight. We're here to help heal, inspire, and create better, healthier lives. Welcome. Well, hello everyone, and welcome to today's show. As always, I am so glad you are here listening, whether it is your first time listening or you've listened to several podcasts. I really always value and appreciate the fact that you're here. I do this show thinking about what listeners want to hear, what would be beneficial. And so I thought about that, with today's show as well. And I know a lot of people have a history of dieting, of having the goal of losing weight. And maybe even some people listening have sought the help of a nutritionist, a dietitian. And you know, I know there's a lot of confusion about what does a dietitian do, or people maybe even think, I don't want to go see somebody because all they're going to do is talk to me about everything I already know about food. I know what food does. I don't need anyone telling me more about that. Or maybe some people go, you know what, I want somebody to finally tell me how to eat so that I can reach my goals of looking a certain way and losing weight. So I hear all these things. It's very common, but today's guest is here to talk about how she works differently with people to help them actually make peace with food and move on in their lives so that they're much healthier and happier. So that being said, I'm going to introduce my guest. Melissa Rumsey is a registered dietitian, nutrition therapist, certified intuitive eating counselor, and the author of Unapologetic Eating, Make Peace with Food and Transform Your Life. She is passionate about supporting people as they reclaim the space to eat and live unapologetically. She is the founder of Rumsey Nutrition Consulting, a weight-inclusive nutrition practice that offers virtual counseling, group programs, and online trainings to support people as they liberate themselves from dieting. She wants them to cultivate a peaceful relationship to food and their bodies and live a more authentic life. Her expertise has been featured in hundreds of media outlets, and she speaks regularly at events, online trainings, and conferences around the country. She calls New York City home and spends her free time cuddling with her cats, Ginny and Lucy, exploring the city's food scene, and searching for patches of green space to sunbathe in. All right. So, Alyssa, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
Well, I'm happy you're here. And, you know, obviously I have like your bio, but I always like to know a little bit about like you as a person. And if you're willing to share, would you kind of tell me a little bit more about like how you got to this place in your life and your career and a little bit more about like you?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's an interesting question for me as well, because I think, you know, I've been a dietitian for coming up on 16 years and, you know, kind of going back, that was something that came actually out of my own experience with disordered eating and dieting, was when I decided to start being a dietitian. And, so I think it's been this many years of kind of unpacking this identity, because it was this identity that started for me in high school as like the quote unquote healthy eater. You know, prior to that, I was someone, I have a straight sized body, I have a lot of body privilege. So I actually didn't really have any kind of negative experiences with food or comments about food or my body until high school. Mm. So I sort of feel like I was very lucky to, in childhood, not really think at all about my body or, I guess specifically sort of like food and my body, and kind of ate what I wanted and didn't think too much of it. And then hit puberty, which coincided with not playing as many sports as I used to when I was younger, and gained weight that I now know is very normal. It's very normal to gain weight at that time of life. And it felt very scary. And that's when that kind of began my dieting. And I was also really into the science of food, although again, it's so hard to kind of pull those pieces apart because it began when I was dieting. I also started going to a gym, and befriended a trainer who was maybe not giving me the best nutrition advice, but I got really into the science of it as well, and learned that there was a career that you could actually do this and talk to people about food. And so, you know, I went into the field of nutrition with already kind of a disordered, you know, sort of mine was really like orthorexic, like a real focus on health. But also weight too, tied in there. And then, yeah, in my career, I actually worked in a large teaching hospital in an intensive care unit. So doing very different work to what I do now. But I honestly think that that really helped me because I wasn't, you know, I was doing very different type of nutrition care. I wasn't working kind of in a counseling setting or working with people who wanted to lose weight. I was working with people who were really sick and needed nutrition to get better. And also fell into a group of friends where everyone kind of had pretty good relationships with food and sort of like slowly over time started healing my own relationship with food. And then at this point, I was working for myself. I had my own practice for a little over 9 years and stumbled upon this thing called intuitive eating. And it just, I mean, it clicked so much. It was kind of like twofold. There was this part of me that was like, oh my gosh, how have I been a dietitian for, I don't know, 8 years and never heard of this? And how have I never learned any of this? And also in thinking about my own experience with food and body weight and thinking about my clients' experience, I was like, oh, this makes so much sense. Like, this is what's happening. The yo-yo dieting, the weight cycling. Yeah, this is why. And so that really was a pivotal point in my career and really shifted the path to where I'm at now.
Awesome. Thank you for sharing that. Because I think it is helpful to know like how people get to where they're at and how they're practicing now. And it's a very common experience, I think, for people in this field to have their own experiences. And I'm actually curious, so when you say where you're at now, like, can you explain a little bit more about how you're practicing now versus maybe how you have in the past?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, so when I first started my private practice, I was practicing from what I consider a more weight-centric approach. So focusing on weight loss, you know, with the bend of like mindfulness and body cues and things like that, but still with this, like, I will help you lose weight. And with this belief that anyone could and should lose weight. And so my introduction into intuitive eating really also introduced me to the Health at Every Size framework of care, which introduced me to fat acceptance movement, and really the social justice underpinnings of so much of this work. And so where I'm at now is, you know, shifted from this weight-centric approach to what I consider a weight-inclusive approach, meaning that the folks that I work with, you know, most of them are still have at least part of themselves that wants to lose weight or isn't accepting of their body, doesn't like how their body looks. And there's another part of them that recognizes, okay, the way I've been doing things has not been helping. And it's actually probably been harming me, whether that's dieting, you know, leading to disordered eating behaviors and eating disorders. And so that's kind of the common thread in the work that I do, is that we're definitely working with sort of these two parts of folks, like the part that is scared to give up weight loss, which again makes so much sense in this culture we live in where there is so much weight bias. It makes sense that someone would want to try to protect themselves from that. Yeah. And this part of them that's like, you know, doing this is not letting me live the life I want to live. It is holding me back from doing things. I'm not able to live out my values. It's taking up so much headspace and time. And so, you know, really holding space for all of these parts of them. And yeah, and so that work is really much more, I mean, it is all counseling focused. You know, a lot of dietitians were very much trained in like education and sort of fixing. And this is like, you know, I actually have a section in my book called, you know, letting go of fixing, because this is not trying to fix, it's trying to help folks better understand themselves and better understand and sort of be with themselves. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, again, everyone I work with has autonomy to do what feels the best for them. And I really see my role as helping them figure that out and helping them get more clear and helping them explore and have a sounding board and have someone reflecting back what they're noticing. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so it's been really powerful because, you know, it's one of those things when I was getting into this intuitive eating type work, I was like, oh, you know, my clients are going to be able to, like, I'm going to help people be able to eat and not feel guilty, which absolutely is a huge outcome of the work that I do with people. And very quickly, I realized that there are these like other outcomes, because food is just kind of like the starting point. Mm-hmm. And as people heal their relationship with food, it impacts all these other things in their life in such a positive way. So that's been so, so cool to see. And really the piece that, yes, you know, one of my friends, I quote her in the book, my friend Hannah Jung, she talks about like, we're all going up the same mountain and just different paths to get there. And sort of, you know, I see my role as people who are kind of attacking this personal development and this growth and self-awareness through the food lens.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, you brought up like how it impacts people when they shift their relationship with food in all sorts of different ways. And, you know, you and I were talking a little bit before we got on here about how it's about the food, which is, you know, obviously why they're coming to see you for food, but it has nothing to do with the food at the same time. And I think that's the part, maybe even people listening kind of going, wait, what do you mean? Of course it's about the food. Like, I don't know, somebody asked you that, like, what do you mean it's not about the food? Like, what would you say to somebody who might ask you that?
Yeah. Well, I'd say that, you know, what kind of presents as like, oh, I have a problem with food or a problem with my body, those are actually the symptoms. They're not really the problem. Mm-hmm. And what's kind of presenting as this problem with food or body image is really reflective of experiences this person has had. It's reflective of the culture that we live in, all these different like systems of oppression, including the weight bias we spoke about, that are present here. And so, you know, really it kind of presents us this problem with food. And again, we start there, but it's kind of like, what's underneath this? You know, I was just having a conversation with someone earlier this week about, yeah, it being, it's not really about the food. It's about the control, or it's about managing anxiety, or it's about numbing feelings, or it's about acceptance and belonging, which all humans want. Mm-hmm. And then I think the other piece is, you know, through working through this food lens and working to reconnect to body cues, working to relearn and kind of trust ourselves around food again, that trust then can translate into all other areas of our life. So when we trust ourselves, when we trust our bodies, when we don't feel like we need an expert or a diet or someone outside of us to tell us what we need, then that trust ends up going through all other areas of our life. And, you know, I talk about in my book, this idea that when we become more like free and liberated with food, we really get liberated from all these other kind of shoulds and supposed tos that we've internalized, like these things we've been taught. You know, so for example, like I see people like either like changing their job, like realizing like, wait, this is not what I want to do. Making decisions about relationships that feel more aligned. Hobbies. I mean, this was a big one. This comes up with so many people of like, oh, wait, now I have all this time again, like, what do I want to do with this time now that I'm not using it to like think about my body or try to fix my body or think about food? Mm-hmm. And so it really helps people just reconnect with themselves in all these other ways and like build back that trust.
Do you think, well, I'm actually curious, do people come to you and like they want you to give them like some, like some way of eating, some structured way, some like plan that's like, quote unquote, finally going to work? Because I find like so many people, maybe not even people I work with, but are so confused or looking for like the final thing that's actually going to, quote unquote, work, whatever that is for them. And I'm wondering if people just come to you asking like, well, does, you know, whatever work, the diet of the day, I call it like intermittent fasting or keto or this or that, are they looking for you to validate like whatever they've taken on or heard about is going to work or not work, whatever. We can talk about what work means in a second, but do you find that people are either really like wedded to eating in a certain way, to your point, like that an expert has said or whatever is out there in social media that's touted as like the diet of the day, or wanting you to give them some alternative that's like gonna be better, and like really struggling with letting go of needing some prescribed kind of way to eat?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think the people that come to me are generally very confused. Mm-hmm. They've usually done all the diets or lots of different diets, and have like all these different food rules that they've internalized through mm-hmm. years of whether that's actively dieting or even, you know, I see folks who they've never like, quote unquote, been on a diet, mm-hmm. but they've been, you know, in this culture that's so focused on dieting, and like they've still internalized these food rules. So often when people come to me, they're just like very disconnected from their bodies. Mm-hmm. They sometimes have a hard time telling me what they like, or if they can tell me what they like, the foods that they say they like really love, those are all things that they're not letting themselves have usually. Yeah. Very disconnected from body cues, you know, not able, kind of able to tell when they're like very hungry, but not really able to tell anything earlier than that, like, oh my gosh, I need to eat right now, starving point.
Yeah.
You know, disconnected from fullness, satisfaction, and honestly, like just that really not even going into their decisions around like what, when, or how much to eat, like all those decisions really being driven by these external food rules that they've internalized. And then just feeling like very confused, because often those food rules might contradict one another. And the other thing that LSA people have in common is just feeling like out of control at times around food and sort of going through these periods of, okay, I gotta like get myself back on track and, you know, start these food rules again, or I'll start over on Monday. And then that working for a little bit, and then it like boomeranging back. And whether that's like week over week, whether that's like good during the week, quote unquote, bad during the weekends, often it's in the course of a day, like, okay, today is going to be better. And then by the end of the day, for a variety of reasons that we can talk about, you know, just like the wheels come off and it's like feeling really out of control. And so that's a lot of what I see, is they're kind of like very confused about what to trust or believe, really no trust with their own body, and very minimal connection generally with their own body, and really it being external reasons or signals that they're using for eating, like nothing really internal.
Mm-hmm. Right. So yeah, that's a great answer. Because I think that is the issue. But and when you're talking about like even within the context of a day, things kind of falling apart, like the wheels coming off. Even I was thinking back to my eating disorder days, and just it sounds like a nightmare. Just to think about like having to adhere to these prescribed ways of eating and like having it be so structured and feeling like, oh my gosh, I failed because I ate like one meal like where it wasn't perfect, or you know, it was off and I screwed up for the day, and like all bets are off now, right? okay, I'm going to get back on track tomorrow and be perfect tomorrow. It's like, it's just not sustainable.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's exhausting. And I think often people are blaming themselves. Like, what's wrong with me that I can't stick to this diet or do this thing? And that's one of the things I always tell them. I'm like, it's not your fault. This is actually your body doing what it's supposed to do. Because mm-hmm. our bodies are wired for survival. And so any restriction or like threat of restriction, our bodies are responding with these cues because it's trying to keep us alive. Mm-hmm. And now people say, well, I have so much food around, you know, for those of us who are food secure, like having access to food nowadays mm-hmm. is not an issue, but our bodies are still wired from thousands and thousands of years ago when food was scarce. And so it still responds in that way. And that can be, you know, if you're not eating enough during the day, that can also be like the sort of mental restriction thoughts around like, oh, I shouldn't be doing this, or I'll start over again tomorrow. So your body gets this sort of message of like, well, better get it in now. Mm-hmm. And we see this, we see, you know, appetite cues increase, hunger increases. We see changes in like the hunger fullness hormones. We see cravings increase specifically generally for like high fat and high sugar foods, which makes sense because if we really were in a famine, like those are the things that would keep us alive, right? Like getting in high calorie foods would keep us alive. And so I always tell people, I'm like, it's not, anything to do with your willpower or, you know, you not being able to control yourself. It's literally you're working against biology here.
Yeah. So anyone listening, it's yes. Take that in. Right. I think people do blame themselves. Like, I'm lacking willpower. I just need to be better. I just need to try harder. Something's wrong with me. I failed again. I hear that word constantly, failure. They feel guilty. They feel bad. They blame themselves. And I can't say this enough on this podcast. Like, you're not the failure. These are setting you up to fail. These are not sustainable. None of these things that quote unquote work. How long do they work? I mean, what does that even mean?
Right, right, right. And I mean, I think that's also kind of the conversations around dieting are framing as working being losing weight mm-hmm. and like keeping that weight off, working being controlling my eating, working being I'm going to eat healthier, quote unquote, whatever that means. and yeah, I think that, you know, what most folks see is that it might quote unquote work in the short term, but then in the long term, and this is also what we see with diet research, is that in the long term, again, because we're working against our biology, these just don't maintain long term. Also because not only are we working against our biology, but we're like, you know, often a lot of these things require us to override our own body cues, which again is only going to work for so long. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, a lot of what I also work on with folks is like reframing, like, okay, what is working? What does that mean? Okay. You say you want weight loss, you're not comfortable in your body. Like, what would be different if you did lose weight? And then, you know, are there things that we might be able to kind of work on? So for example, you know, I hear a lot like, oh, I want to have more energy. I want to sleep better. I want to be able to move better. And I'm like, okay, well, we can work on those kind of outcomes or those goals that you're working for and like let your weight fall where it may. So I think a lot too is sort of kind of taking apart weight and health being so like, inextricably linked, because yes, there's correlation with weight and health. And when we put all our eggs in this basket of like getting healthier means eating less, exercising more, losing weight, we really can lose sight. And for a lot of people, like they don't actually feel better. They might in the short term, but then like their mental health, for example, can get worse. Anxiety can get worse. Depression can get worse. This is where eating disorders can come into play too. If they're overriding their body cues, they might physically not feel good either. And so, you know, a lot of it is helping folks kind of figure out for themselves, like, what does health mean to you? And broadening that definition of health away from just body size.
And it, you know, to your point too, that you said before, people are confused, right? Because, you know, I'll look online too, and it can be confusing, right? Like, there's all this quote unquote research saying like this, if you eat this way or you don't eat these things, the research says people live longer or they're, you know, health, quote unquote, physically healthier or this or that. And then you read people's, I don't know, on Reddit or whatever, like, oh, when I did this keto intermittent fasting, I, you know, felt so much better and I have so much more energy. And the doctors say, you know, the research says like organisms live longer and it's healthy to do this and that. And people constantly tell me, oh, I heard that if you fast, like, you know, it's good for you and it's good for humans. And I'm like, oh my gosh, like, where do we sift through the noise and stop all of this? Like,
yeah. Yeah, because there is, oh my God, so much noise, right? And we just keep getting more and more noise in the internet age and now with AI. And like, yeah, most people spend so much time online, and especially with social media and like everything getting with our short attention spans, like even shorter, we can be online for like 10, 15 minutes and have intaken like all of this information. And so again, I like to tell people like, okay, let's go back to you.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how can we figure out like what way of eating feels best to you? Because yeah, sure, you can probably pull up research to support anything you want. Like, there's lots of issues with research in general, but also specific to like food and nutrition research. And you know, one of those things is that the length of time that they tend to follow folks tends to be very short. I just saw something recently and it was, I forget the exact headline, but they were declaring like, yeah, some of what you were saying of like, this is the way. And then it was like, participants were followed for 6 weeks. I was like, 6 weeks, right? Like, so, and again, like, you know, I always say to people, okay, well, let's think about it. Okay. You're considering doing whatever diet or eating pattern. What's happened in the past when you've tried to do things like that?
Mm-hmm.
And usually what most people say is that it worked for a little bit and then it wasn't sustainable. And maybe like certain parts of it were helpful, but then it wasn't sustainable. Then, you know, when they quote unquote, like broke the diet, they felt like super out of control. And so, you know, again, I think it's a lot sort of reflecting for yourself of like, what do you know to be true? Like, what have your experiences been with trying to make food decisions from these external places? And then that can open up space, and not everyone is there. And I totally understand that, but it can start to open up space for folks to think about like, okay, what would be best for me? And how can I start to explore this connection to my body? Because we're all, I know you had, I think I saw you had Elise Raish, one of the writers of Intuitive Eating, on the podcast recently. And I'm sure she talked about this, about like, yeah, we're all born with this inherent connection to our body and this ability to know like what and how much we need. And yet for a variety of reasons, we, you know, sadly for a lot of people, this starts in childhood, but certainly into adulthood, we're just so disconnected from that.
Yeah.
So I think it's, like allowing people the space to be like, what would that be like to make some decisions and pay more attention to like what feels good to me and what feels good, like eating in a way that feels like self-care rather than self-control, or eating in a way of respecting my body rather than like punishing it.
Yeah, I don't even know if people know anymore. I think there is a lot of punishing and a lot of fear of breaking whatever rules are out there. Like, oh gosh, if I don't look like the body ideal that's out there, then I'm doing something wrong, right? To your point, like, there's a lot of pressure. Like, I have to look a certain way. What if your body's not meant to look like that? And to be honest with you, I don't think we talk about this enough. Like, 95% of people genetically don't look like that if they're physically well and healthy. And like, you know, it's like, who's looking like that anyway?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, totally. And I think that's Like that's one of the things that we do live in this diet culture and this culture where thinness is held up as the ideal. And, you know, again, speaking as someone with thin privilege, like I don't want to make light of this because it is really hard. It can be really hard to live in a larger body in our culture and in our society. And, you know, these kind of beliefs about thinness being the way, like those didn't come from nowhere. Like those have roots. You know, Dr. Sabrina String's research talks a lot about the roots of fat phobia and the thin ideal in anti-Blackness. You know, these roots in keeping certain groups of people more oppressed. And like, if you think about it, if we don't trust ourselves, if we're relying on others to like tell us what we need to do, how we need to look, it's going to be really hard to like be in our power and to like really be able to do these things. Like it's easier to control groups of people when they don't trust themselves. And, you know, again, I said before, like these clients I work with that they find like so much time opens up in their life and they're like, whoa, what do I do with this time? We think about that. Like what would we do if we were not, if all of us were not concerned with the size of our bodies or what we looked like as much or what we ate, like the amount of time that would open up. And again, holding like that is really hard because we still live in a culture where fat people are discriminated against. You know, there's research around like they tend to make less money. You know, I have so many clients and colleagues and friends who go to the doctor's office and like don't get good care because of the size of their body. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, so it's kind of like holding all of these things. And again, for everyone kind of coming back to your own, I do a lot of values work with my clients. I'm like, okay, what do you want your life to look like? What is important to you? And how can we make decisions based on those sorts of things? You know, and that's going to look different for everybody. But right now, we're all making decisions based on something. And if we haven't like really kind of connected to ourselves, we end up making a lot of decisions through the lens of like our culture's values, which might not be aligned with our own. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think it's, and I also find for a lot of people I work with, like understanding the roots of where this stuff comes from, like, yeah, thinness, it's not like a fact that thinness is better than fatness or that like, mm-hmm. right, like this, it's a cultural belief that was created purposefully. And so a lot of times, like actually understanding that can be really helpful in people, like in this sort of zooming out away from the individual experience into this sort of like collective experience. And that I find can be really helpful too. So we'll often talk about a lot of these things and talk about, yeah, the experiences that they've had in their body. And there's a lot of power in being able to like, it can be hard, but like in being able to like connect to those experiences and talk about those experiences. And again, connecting, like building that connection to yourself and your values and your beliefs. And then how do you want to live your life?
Right. And curious too, for anyone listening, is it just sometimes genetically impossible to even diet your way into a smaller body, regardless of like whatever diet you take on? Because I think there is that belief, that myth, whatever it is, it's like, if I just had enough willpower, if I just did this diet perfectly long enough and exercised enough, I will be able to look this way or lose enough weight or be in this size.
Yeah. I think that's something that diet culture tells us, right? And because I also think we have to talk about that. The dieting industry is this like hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars a year industry, mm-hmm. that profits off of people believing that lie, that like, oh, if I just work hard enough, then I can get to this point. And, you know, body diversity is a real thing. Like, just like there's height diversity, we're not all the same height. There's also weight diversity. And so, yeah, it's, you know, everyone kind of has their own sort of like set point weight range where their body feels the most comfortable. And that's not necessarily in a quote unquote normal BMI range or in a thin body. And so, yeah, that's another reason why, you know, always talking about, it's not about willpower and control, because if you get below that set point, so sometimes people do lose below that set point, but then it's like impossible to maintain. Mm-hmm. And because, yeah, their bodies aren't meant to be at that place. And that can be, you know, sometimes it can be liberating to kind of know that it's like, mm-hmm. oh, it's not my fault. It can also be, there can be like a grieving period too, mm-hmm. of like, oh, I'll never get there.
Yeah.
Which, yeah, like that's also a lot of the work that I do with folks is like, yeah, holding space for that, because that can be understandably really challenging. So yeah, I think absolutely body diversity is real, and we're all not meant, I mean, the BMI is total BS.
yeah.
And those cutoffs totally arbitrary. And yeah, we're not meant to all be in that, you know, quote unquote normal range. And there's nothing wrong with you if your body is like not meant to be in that range.
Yeah, I don't think we talk about that enough. I think people think, oh my gosh, I'm eating so little and exercising so much, and I still don't look anywhere now like that. I'm still not in this small size. Like, what am I doing wrong? And it's like, okay, gosh, I got to just eat less. I got to like exercise more. I got to try harder. I got to this. And that, to your point, like in the medical field, it's like, well, you're still in this high BMI category, but it's like, at some point you were just actually becoming very unhealthy and hurting yourself. And you're doing something to try to look a certain way that you're not ever going to look anyway, unless you really do die. You know, like to my point, like that scares me. And I don't know why we don't talk about that. It's like, not everyone is going to be able to actually look like that unless they really do some things to kill themselves and hurt themselves. Mm-hmm. Like, that's the part that really makes me sad. It's like, oh my gosh, like, what are we doing as a society? This is awful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. That's making me think too of the diagnosis of atypical anorexia.
Yeah.
You know, usually when we say anorexia, most people picture like a very emaciated, typically young white woman is mm-hmm. often what comes to mind for folks. And, you know, there's so much wrong with the DSM and with, you know, it's created by humans. And so like, there's going to be things that are not great about that. And yeah, anorexia nervosa has a weight component to it. Atypical anorexia and anorexia have the same exact physical and mental symptoms, with the exception of the weight piece. Mm-hmm. And so the only reason why it's called atypical is just because, you know, the people, mostly men probably, who wrote the DSM assumed that if someone was under eating and restricting, that they'd be in a smaller body. Mm-hmm. So that's like their weight bias showing there. And yeah, people can have raging eating disorders and still not be thin.
Yeah, exactly.
Be really, really sick and still not be thin.
Even in much larger bodies and have like, I work with many people who are in what people would consider larger bodies in our society, and they have dieted their way down to where their metabolism is so low. They are eating so very, very few calories. It's actually scary, and exercising a lot. And they come in, they're just crying. They're saying, if I eat more than this, I gain weight so quickly. They feel like they can only consume what their body is now used to. And it's to me, that is heartbreaking. Yeah. And it's scary.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, yeah, dieting can really wreak havoc on our bodies, like physically, mentally, emotionally.
So if anyone is out there and you're in that position where you're just actually afraid to eat more than you are, and it's very low in terms of fuel. And that is one of the criteria for anorexia nervosa, the fear of gaining weight, the fear of that, right? Like that. So you're caught in this horrible cycle, like, know that you need help. Like, this is something you absolutely cannot do on your own. You're at that point where that's a scary place to be, because, you know, the other thing about this too, right, Alyssa, is these eating disorders do kill people. Right. They need to see someone like you too, right, to learn how to fuel themselves so that they can stay alive. Mm-hmm. Like, food is not an option. It's about the food in that respect, right? The food is like life sustaining.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And I think that's also something that is just not talked about enough, is the like medical effects and mortality rate of, of eating disorders. And people, again, like, when we say that, just again saying like, that's not just really skinny people, it's like all body sizes can be affected. Mm-hmm. And eating disorders are so much more common than we think. And less than 6% of people that have an eating disorder are quote unquote underweight. So that means like, what, 94% are in a quote normal BMI range or overweight or obese quote unquote range. So they don't have a look, and they're one of the deadliest mental illnesses, I think second only to opioid use.
And constantly hearing, like, you know, people telling themselves, I'm not sick enough, or I don't look like I have an eating disorder, or people in their lives saying that, well, you don't look like you have an eating disorder, right? Like, these things, like, if anyone listening is saying these things themselves or hearing these things, like, listen to what we're saying. Like, seek some help. You know, and so for you too, like, Alyssa, if people do want to reach out to you, work with you, get your book, like, how can they find you and get more information?
Yeah, because there is hope, and you do deserve help and support. Absolutely. So my book, Unapologetic Eating, is available wherever books are sold. So it's available in bookstores. It's available on Amazon at bookshop.org. You can also learn more about me and working together on my website, alyssarumsey.com. More information and resources and ways that we can work together are all available there.
Fantastic. Thank you. That information will be all in the show notes. Any last final words before we end?
I would just say, you know, again, reiterating, there is hope, and that there's so much freedom and liberation available to you. And it can feel so, so tough. And it can feel like this is never going to get better, or I just have to live like this. And you don't. There is so much freedom on the other side. And, you know, freedom, not just with food, but also freedom from, all of these societal shoulds or supposed tos, really being able to live a life that feels values aligned and joyful to you.
I love that you said that, because that's like one of the biggest reasons I do this podcast, is to instill hope. So love that last message. So thank you so very much for being here.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
This podcast is designed to provide accurate and authoritative information in regards to the subject matter covered. It is given with the understanding that neither the host, the publisher, or the guests are rendering legal, accounting, clinical, or any other professional information. If you want a professional, you should find one.